Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. We are privileged each week to have an extraordinary contribution made to our intelligence briefings of you all by Gordon Chang, one of our country's preeminent experts on, well, the great challenge of our time, namely the Chinese Communist Party. He is a man of considerable accomplishment, an author of numerous books, including The Coming Collapse of China and the Great U.S.-China Tech War. He is also, I think, one of the most prolific men I know with respect to various periodical publications, including at Gatestone Institute and Newsweek. He is also a very, very impressive contributor to the public policy debate through his tweets at Gordon G. Chang, and I encourage you to follow him there as I do. Gordon, it's so good to have you back with us. There's a lot to talk about today. Glad to have some time to do so.
Well, thank you so much, Frank.
I want to start by thanking you for participating in a program that, as we speak, is in the future, and as this program goes to air, will be in the rearview mirror. I can commend it to all of our listeners, as I did in my commentary for today. It is on the topic of, are you investing in America's destruction? And you play a featured role, Gordon, really as kind of the keynote speaker about why it is that we may be facing destruction at the hands of the Chinese Communist Party. Talk a little bit about, you know, what you'll be saying in the course of this webinar, and people can sign up or find out about it, certainly, at presentdangerchina.org. What will you be saying, Gordon, and how do you think this program hopefully makes an important contribution to the public debate, as I say, about what the Chinese are up to and what we should be doing about it?
I'll be talking about the context of China-U.S. relations. And there we have to start with the May 2019 piece in People's Daily, which declared a quote-unquote people's war on the United States. And this is sets the groundwork for China's strike against American interest, or indeed against America. And we know that the Chinese are serious because in this year, especially in August, People's Daily and the tabloid it controls, Global Times, continued to establish this justification for a strike on America. On the 29th of August, People's Daily carried a piece that said the United States was conducting quote-unquote barbaric acts against China. And just a little before that, the Global Times mentioned that the United States was working with China's enemies. We have to remember that James Lilly, our great ambassador to Beijing at the end of the 1980s and the beginning of the 1990s, said that China always telegraphs its punches. And what China is doing right now is telegraphing its punches. And that means the United States needs to have a very different attitude toward China than we see in this administration and even in previous ones.
Gordon, for those not familiar with Chinese terminology, define what past experience, if nothing else, suggests they mean by the term people's war.
Well, people's war is something that is a term that they don't use lightly, because as China says, as they said in May 2019, don't say we didn't warn you. So this shows that Beijing believes that it is in an existential struggle with the U.S. And this is not just propaganda, because we have seen, for instance, China take steps that have resulted in the deaths of hundreds of thousands of Americans, and this in just the last couple of years. So, for instance, whatever the origin of SARS-CoV-2, the pathogen that causes COVID-19 is, and we can't say with 100% assurance what it is, although it does look like it comes from the lab. But the point is, we know with 100% assurance that China took steps to deliberately spread this beyond its borders. It lied about contagiousness. It told the world SARS-CoV-2 was not contagious when they knew that it was highly transmissible from human to human. And while they were locking down their own country, telling us that they thought lockdowns were effective, they were pressuring other countries, especially the United States, not to impose travel restrictions and quarantines on arrivals from China. And that is now about 783,000 Americans who have been killed by this disease, and also 5.2 million people outside China. Also, there is, of course, fentanyl. China is behind its criminal gangs that make fentanyl compounds and distribute them around the world. And it also helps other Chinese gangs launder the proceeds of this criminal activity through the Chinese state banks. That was perhaps maybe 64,000 Americans in the last 12-month period that President Biden talked about in his address on overdoses. This is by itself tens of thousands of American deaths each year. We should consider each of those deaths a murder, as we should consider the coronavirus deaths outside China. So this is a malicious regime conducting unrestricted warfare. So when they say people's war, Frank, they're not kidding.
You used the term that I was hoping you might introduce here, Gordon. We'll be talking about it in the course of the webinar today from 1 o'clock to 3 p.m. Eastern Time. Unrestricted warfare. Would you say that the COVID attack, based on what you've rightly pointed out, was certainly efforts to maximize the damage, however this thing emerged from China's labs, and the fentanyl opium war, if you would, are examples of unrestricted warfare in furtherance of the agenda of people's war by the Chinese Communist Party against us?
Yes, Frank. I don't know any other term that would fit. Beijing believes that there is nothing out of bounds. It is not bound by any laws or rules. There is no tactic too malicious, too dangerous for it to engage in. And we Americans need to understand that we're involved in an existential struggle. And this has nothing to do with what we have in our relations with China. This is just the mere fact that we have a democratic form of governance. We believe in human rights. We believe in free markets. China believes that the inspirational impact of our form of government, of the way our society operates, that inspirational impact on the Chinese people is not only a direct threat to Chinese communism, but an existential one. And that's why it does believe it can do whatever it wants and whatever it can to end our government and end our society. So, I'll pick on Biden for the moment, but this is also true of his predecessors. And that is, this is not a competition, as Biden says. This is more than just an adversarial relationship. This is an existential struggle. And we Americans have to understand we can lose our society. We have not adopted that viewpoint. And so therefore, even though we're a far stronger society than China, and especially China is fragile at the moment, even though we're a far stronger society, we can lose everything.
So just to recap, you're saying that it's not just that we are the obvious impediment to the realization of Xi Jinping's China dream of dominating the world, which would justify, presumably, their enmity and their desire for our destruction. But you're saying that our very existence, Gordon Chang, is considered by the Chinese a threat to the regime, a threat to their success at home, as well as their international aspirations?
It's an existential threat, Frank, because they realize the inspirational impact that our values have, that our society has on China. So, yes, our mere existence.
I want to come back to this point about where that leaves us, Gordon, with you in a moment. But let me just drill down a little bit. You've described, I think, very powerfully the kinds of people's war that the Chinese have been engaging against us, but there's a people's war in a sense against people of China as well, specifically those in Western China, Xinjiang, as the Chinese communists call it, that are being genocidally persecuted, oppressed, murdered by the regime. And there has been a report that the Chinese dictator, Xi Jinping, has been personally implicated in that genocidal campaign. This isn't exactly a surprise if you know anything about how totalitarian systems work, but evidently it's now been documented. Gordon, tell us about what we now know in connection specifically with Xi's role in this horrifying behavior.
In the last 3 or 4 days, a series of documents, including speeches, were released and leaked. And they show Xi Jinping's role in ordering the atrocities in Xinjiang. And these atrocities meet the definition of genocide in Article 2 of the Genocide Convention of 1948. But there are also other crimes. For instance, there is murder. We know that because of witness testimony, but also because China built a crematorium and a cemetery between two of its internment camps. There is torture. There is rape, which is a part of official policy. There is the government's running of slave programs where tens of thousands of Uyghurs, Kazakhs, and others, their labor is offered to foreign and domestic companies. There is forced organ harvesting, from all that we can tell. So these atrocities are crimes against humanity, and they directly come from Xi Jinping, who has ordered this. And we also know this even before the leak of papers, because many of these policies were put in place in Tibet, and the Communist Party secretary of Tibet was transferred to Xinjiang in 2017. And these policies were implemented and actually amplified. This is a communist system. It's top down. Something of this order could not occur in China without a direct involvement of and approval by the Politburo Standing Committee, of which, of course, Xi Jinping, as General Secretary of the Communist Party, heads. So we have further proof with these papers, but we knew this all along.
Which brings me to the question of whether we should be legitimating this regime, Gordon, by participating in any form or fashion in what I think are properly called the genocide games, the so-called Olympics of winter 2022 in February in Beijing. There is, against the backdrop of that sporting contest, now a boycott of China by the Women's Tennis Association in connection with the disappearance and obvious mistreatment of a Chinese tennis star by the name of Peng Shui. Talk a bit about what is going on here, Gordon, and how it really reinforces the point that we should not be in any way legitimating or otherwise honoring this government of Xi Jinping's.
The background, Peng Shui, which you mentioned, is that on November 2, on her verified Weibo account, which is sort of like Twitter, she accused Zhang Gaoli and his wife of rape. Zhang was a vice premier of the Chinese state. He was also sitting on the Politburo Standing Committee for 5 years, now retired. And that post was taken down within 30 minutes, and she was immediately disappeared. She has reappeared in propaganda videos and in a video conference with the International Olympic Committee of 2 Sundays ago. But clearly she is not free to say what she wants. Yesterday, the Women's Tennis Association suspended all of its tournaments in China because of its treatment of Peng, who, by the way, was a two-time Grand Slam champion, doubles champion, as well as a three-time Olympian. And now there is pressure on other sporting organizations to also pull their events from China. The International Olympic Committee says it's going forward with the Beijing Olympics, which start on February 4. And there is a move to boycott them, but I believe that boycott is inadequate. What we should be doing are two things. One of them is moving the games away from China to a country that is not implicated in crimes against humanity. Plus, also, I believe that the International Olympic Committee must ban the participation of all Chinese teams from all Olympics. And the reason is that a significant portion of the Chinese population, Tibetans, Uyghurs, Kazakhs, and other Turkic minorities, are not allowed to participate in sport. The IOC banned South Africa just before the Tokyo Summer Olympics of 1964 for apartheid because a significant portion of the South African population couldn't participate in sport. What China is doing is far worse than the apartheid of South Africa. And so I believe that there is an obligation on the part of the IOC to ban Chinese teams. Those two things we must do. Ban Chinese teams, move the games. A boycott call, I think, is inadequate considering the situation we are now in.
That's such a telling point, and I'm glad you've made it here. I think it's definitely one that should be adopted. I've been personally promoting this idea of a boycott for quite some time, and I think you're right. This has to be intensified, especially against the backdrop of that South Africa precedent, as you say, Gordon. Unfortunately, at the same moment that we should be moving in the opposite direction, we have, of course, not just athletes headed to Beijing shortly, but it's corporate sponsors of these games, many of them American. The Chinese are apparently now putting the squeeze on companies both in the financial sector, that's been going on for some time, and I gather other American companies doing business in China to toe the party line, as they say. Tell us what we know about this, Gordon, and its implication.
Well, most recently, a vice foreign minister, Xi Feng, in China, told American businesses that they can no longer make fortunes in China and remain silent, which means that he believes that they need to speak up against the move to boycott the Winter Olympics. In other words, what China is doing is weaponizing our biggest companies against us, which means I believe that it's time for the President of the United States to prohibit all American companies and citizens from doing business with China. You know, if China wants to use our companies against us, then we can no longer permit that. And so now's the time for a complete decoupling in the business sense. This is not the only thing that should occur, of course, Frank. We should be ending technical cooperation agreements among NGOs and hospitals and research institutes and universities and the rest of it. We should be getting China's agents out of our country. All sorts of things that need to be done. But this is a point, as I mentioned before, that we can lose our country. And China exploits every point of contact with America to destroy our society. So until we can be sure that we can handle this, we need to eliminate all these points of contact. I know many people will think that's drastic, but this is an existential struggle, as the Chinese put it. We are losing it. And so therefore, to keep our society, to keep our freedoms, to keep our democracy, I believe that we have no choice but to end the relationship with China.
I commend you, Gordon, for your clarity on this point. You have a 7-point plan. You've sort of illuminated some of its key elements here. And obviously, it goes without saying, as we will be describing in detail in the course of the webinar today, we must stop underwriting these guys. The corporate shilling for China is one thing. The enabling of the threat that it poses to us, the CCP, is yet worse and must also, of course, be terminated forthwith. Which brings us to your really important piece at the Gatestone Institute published yesterday, Gordon. You've kind of given us the bottom line, but describe what you call the moral imperative to end China's regime.
I believe that, you know, putting apart all of the things that China has done, I believe that because of China's activities, the activities of the regime, we have that moral imperative. And this is a regime, Frank, which is immoral, and it is evil, it is destructive and dangerous, and it goes against civilization. So we're talking about something which is comparable to the Third Reich. And if we look at what China's regime is doing right now, it is actually worse than what the Third Reich was doing prior to the mass exterminations of 1941. So there is, just apart from the things we've been talking about, this is a question now of morality. And when it becomes a question of morality, there can be no compromise, because what the regime is doing. We look back at the British and the French, and even ourselves in the run-up to World War II in Europe, and we say, how could we continue to do business? How could we have allowed Tom Watson of IBM to lease tabulating machines, which the regime used to calculate and keep track of Jews? And we just find that incomprehensible. But look at what's happening right now with the regime that is as evil as the Third Reich was in the 1930s. And so
you look at the companies that are enabling it. We've talked a little bit about the underwriting of it, but I'm thinking about the Googles and the Facebooks, the social media platforms in particular, high-tech companies that are aiding and abetting artificial intelligence and mass surveillance and the social credit system of China, all of which, as you say, Gordon, gives rise to this unbelievably oppressive totalitarian state and the horrors, the moral abominations that it engages in on a daily basis against its own people. And I'm fond of making the point, I think I have with you in the past, Gordon, but certainly with our audience, that any country that treats its own people this abominably is not going to treat ours kindly. That's for sure. Which brings me to a kind of last point, Gordon. We're talking in the course of the webinar today about what do we do about all of this. And one of the things that we'll be launching with this program about Are You Investing in America's Destruction is what we call a Mad as Hell campaign. And that's a phrase, of course, that is taken from a Hollywood script, but it speaks to how Americans ought to feel about the idea that, mostly without their permission, probably almost entirely without their knowledge at least, the capitalists on Wall Street are in fact enabling, empowering, financing, and emboldening our mortal enemy. And we want them to begin to understand that it doesn't have to be that way, that their money doesn't have to be employed in this fashion, and that there are in fact ways that they can ensure that doesn't happen. So we'll be talking more about that in the days ahead, but I wanted just to mention it in this context, that whether it's for moral considerations, human rights values that are central to our society and constitution for that matter, or whether it's just, you know, self-preservation in the face of this existential threat, as you rightly call it, we need to make sure that we're not further making this mortal threat worse, and better yet, bringing it to a screeching halt. This brings me to one last question. I don't know if you've had a chance to see it, but an old friend and much admired colleague by the name of Michael Rubin has a piece in, I believe, the National Interest at the moment, in which he talks about whether we ought to be working on separatist impulses in China to try to help further erode the power of the Chinese Communist Party and diminish the threat it poses to all of us. This has been sort of a staple of the work we've been doing at the Committee on the Present Danger of China in connection with what we call our Captive Nations Coalition, Gordon. But I'd welcome your thoughts on this subject, whether this is an angle of attack we should also be utilizing, especially in light of the fact that this is about freedom for enslaved peoples in not just Xinjiang, but Tibet and southern Mongolia, Hong Kong, and beyond, perhaps.
In that piece you talk about, Michael Rubin reminds us of the Stimson Doctrine, which is U.S. foreign policy is not to recognize boundary changes that have come about through force. And the reason why this is relevant is because in both what China calls the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region, and in the Tibet Autonomous Region, Beijing used force to take over areas that are now inhabited by minorities. And one can also argue Taiwan, where China is threatening to use force, and even Inner Mongolia. So we need to go back to that cornerstone doctrine that Michael talks about, because without it, we cannot allow big aggressors or any party to redraw boundaries with force.
They have done it. It seems as though they are increasingly ramping up their capacity to do it to Taiwan next. And as you've documented so brilliantly in so many ways, Gordon, it's certainly what they're doing with respect to the South China Sea, their ambitions perhaps to wrest from Japan islands they contest, and who knows, perhaps seize territory elsewhere, either in the region or beyond. This is, of course, I think the leitmotif of the Belt and Road Initiative as well. And that's a subject to which we will turn with you, I think, on another occasion. But I just wanted to say, as always, Gordon, your clarity on what we're facing here and the imperative that all of us get clear about this is so appreciated, as are your visits with us each week. You are faithful to a fault in terms of making yourself available here and in so many other programs that we participate in. And I'm really appreciative of you being a very important part of the webinar on Are You Investing in America's Destruction? Check it out, folks, at presentdangerchina.org. Thank you, Gordon Chang, for your time today. Come back to us again next week, and we'll look forward to talking with you a little bit later in the day. God bless you, my friend. Next up, we'll speak with Daniel Greenfield about a whole host of troubles here at home, not least. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome. It's good to have you with us. We're going to be speaking now with Daniel Greenfield. He is a remarkable contributor to the public policy debate, notably in his role as a Shulman Fellow at the David Horowitz Freedom Center. You can follow his work there and at Front Page Magazine, to which he contributes regularly, and of course his blog, danielgreenfield.org, and his Twitter account at Sultan Knish, a man of many parts and a good friend of this program. We're always delighted to have him with us, though it's not been often enough. I hope we can correct that in the future. Daniel Greenfield, it's good to have you with us today. Welcome back.
Thank you. It's my pleasure, my honor to be back.
We're facing, I think, a bevy of things to talk about, many of which you've been addressing in one or the other of your platforms. I thought maybe we'd start with something that's very troubling about what you've written about concerning the Vice President of the United States, Kamala Harris, and her seeming interference with the FBI as it has been monitoring, to the extent it has, black supremacists like the one that is implicated in this murderous attack in Waukesha, rather than the putative, most serious threat to our country from so-called white supremacists. Talk us through that, if you would.
Well, what we're seeing is very similar to what was done with Islamic terrorism. The information about it, the training materials were suppressed. Even the very idea was deemed racist and off limits. Federal enforcement was prevented from learning about the threat, from monitoring the threat, from doing anything about the threat. The same philosophy was being applied to black supremacist groups. Now, black supremacist terrorist groups obviously have a long history of violence dating back to the 60s and 70s at the very least. Notably, Black Lives Matter, their iconic figurehead is a woman named Asata Shakur, who is one of the top wanted domestic terrorists in the United States. She's currently hiding out in Cuba. They use her slogan as their slogan. So there's a long history here. It goes back generations. But a number of years ago, Senator Cory Booker, Senator Kamala Harris, a number of other top Democrats, and a number of actually House members, including Karen Bass, who's now running for mayor of L.A., began aggressively pressuring the FBI to stop monitoring black supremacists. Now, the FBI had a category known as black identity extremists. This was how they referred to black supremacists. Cory Booker, Kamala Harris, a number of others insisted that there was no such thing, that this was something that had been artificially created by federal law enforcement, that they were classing together disparate incidents that had no common denominator. Now, this was obviously blatantly untrue because of the long history involved, and also because there actually had been a recent upsurge in violence connected to the Black Lives Matter movement. And I'm talking beyond the street riots, which had not yet hit critical mass at that point. But you had, for example, the mass shooting of police officers in Dallas, a number of other attacks around the same time, some of them fatal. And these were serious domestic terrorist attacks. Now, the FBI, of course, was quite willing to go ahead to cooperate and to drop the Black identity extremist category. And that was actually the exact intersection when you had an upsurge in serious Black supremacist attacks, a number of them actually originating from a group loosely known as Black Hebrew Israelites, not to be confused with Jews in any way. They're actually quite anti-Semitic, but it's a Black supremacist cult that believes that they are the authentic Jews, that everybody else is racially inferior and pretty much can be wiped out. People who have been around New York City, D.C., some major areas occasionally encounter them doing their street preaching, which is violently racist. Now, in the way this came up around the Covington Catholic case, because a number of these people showed up to a pro-life rally and began yelling racial slurs, homophobic slurs at the students, instigating this entire exchange, which the media falsely misrepresented as in order to smear the boys who were there for the pro-life rally as being racist, when actually it was their own people, this racist Black supremacist group that was actually behind it. Now, a number of other more serious attacks began taking off at that point. The most serious of these was a major attack in Jersey City on a kosher market by two heavily armed gunmen, one of whom had a serious explosive device that would have been capable of doing a great deal of damage. They murdered three people. They shot a police officer before they were taken down. There was another attack also by a BHI member at a synagogue in New York. And there was a machete attack in North Carolina. But the Waukesha attack, maybe the single largest attack, certainly the most murderous attack by anyone seemingly associated with the BHI movement. Now, what was the FBI doing?
This is the one that involved, of course, the vehicle driving into a crowd of Christmas celebrants. And Daniel, again, just to recap, these incidents are individually problematic, of course, but is it your view that they are indisputably joined by a common ideology, at least a sort of Black supremacist character?
Clear pattern there. Both the Christmas parade killer and the attacker in the synagogue in New York both use the same Hitler meme used by BHI members. Certainly, they were all influenced. They were all involved with this Black supremacist movement, and certainly they all held Black supremacist views. Now, considering how loosely the media, Democrats, and even law enforcement now categorize white supremacists, where it takes very little to be described as a white supremacist. Kyle Rittenhouse was being described as a white supremacist based on no real evidence whatsoever. So on the one hand, you have pretty much zero evidence required to describe somebody as a white supremacist. There are obviously actual white supremacist killers out there. But right now, it takes pretty much nothing. If you fly an American flag, you can be described as a white supremacist. If you believe in the concept of individual freedom, there will be training resources that will describe that as a white supremacist idea. Pretty much anything, especially if you listen to somebody like Ibram X. Kendi, is white supremacy. So the bar is pretty much non-existent, whereas the bar for Black supremacists is so infinitely high that no matter what you do, no matter how clearly you identify your political, racial, and hateful views, you can never actually be accused of being a Black supremacist. Thus, for example, the New York killer who came in with a machete into a synagogue, he used the same meme as the Waukesha killer, was described as mentally ill. The Waukesha killer is being kind of written off as fleeing a crime scene, as doing anything but what he very obviously did, which is choose to drive an SUV through a parade into a crowd of people after expressing repeated Black supremacist and racist views.
This fits into the larger sort of paradigm that we're seeing in this country with this endless incantation about the racism, systemic racism of the United States and the, you know, character of it going back to its founding as a racist nation. with clear blind spots, to say the least, with respect to those who are advancing it. Do you concur that this is fundamentally a Marxist play, sort of akin to, not identical, but akin to that of the sort of class warfare that the Maoists used to such great effect in their own country, in China, but have been exporting elsewhere wherever possible, morphed to reflect the reality that class warfare is not a thing in the United States, not likely to resonate, but this racist warfare does?
That's exactly right. If you go back 100 years to the first black race riots, you'll find they were actually organized by communist groups. So much really of what the communists were doing 100 years ago in America then actually trickled down to the socialists and actually became a mainstream Democrat position. Thus, for example, the race riots originally organized by communists now simply become something that Democrats set off whenever they choose to. And as you very perceptively pointed out, this began with class warfare, but increasingly as American opportunity, equality, prevented class warfare from being this defining Marxist premise. They had to switch over to race, but really their idea of race is pretty much the same idea of class. This is a fixed category. The only way to actually adjust it is to completely transform society, to engage in a revolution, violent or political, that will completely overturn everything, and anything that stands in the way is reactionary, and that we are moving to this inevitable crisis, this inevitable collision of races, which really was the selling point for the Obama administration.
Right. And one might argue was the driving force behind much of what's happened to this point in the Biden administration as well. Let me ask you about a character who plays a prominent role, often, I'm afraid, behind the scenes rather than in front of them, but nonetheless is perceptibly working in numbers of ways to advance essentially the agenda you just described, and that would be George Soros. You've been doing some research into his activities, notably with a group called the 1630 Fund. Tell us what it's about and what damage is being wrought by it with his financial support.
So the 1630 Fund is the ultimate dark money machine. They pumped about $400 million into the previous election, and they raised about the same amount. Now, they raised about half of that amount from only four donors. It's a dark money machine, which means they don't have to disclose their donors. But it was documented by Politico that three of their biggest supporters, George Soros, Pierre Omidyar, who is the founder of eBay, he was born to Iranian students in Paris, moved to this country. His mother actually funds a lot of pro-Iranian activism. And finally, Hans-Jörg Wyss, the richest man in Switzerland, who was actually not even a United States citizen, despite pumping hundreds of millions into the American political system, all for the left. He's the richest man in Switzerland. He lives here on an E2 investor's visa, which raises obviously serious questions. There's been an FEC complaint raised about this. Now, you have these three foreign billionaires funding this dark money machine. Now, how does this dark money machine manifest itself? So you will have assorted front groups locally, like Floridians for Fair Elections, that are funded by this. You will have, for example, the Never Trump movement. The Never Trump movement is largely funded by the 1630 Fund. The 1630 Fund is the largest backer of the Lincoln Project, which is infamous for all these attack ads. Pierre Omidyar is the biggest funder of the Bulwark. The 1630 Fund funds Bill Kristol. So you have a lot of the so-called opposition, the so-called different factions, the so-called local groups, including a lot of fake local news operations. A lot of this actually comes directly from this huge dark money machine, which was free to pump $400 million into the previous election, and obviously going to pump a lot of money into the next two elections.
It sounds as though at least some of that dark money was actually illegal. You mentioned that there's an FEC complaint, a Federal Elections Commission complaint, but this would sound to me to be felonious if a foreign national is in this country or elsewhere, for that matter, pumping large sums into political, you know, campaigns or processes. Am I missing something here, Daniel?
It is a serious issue. The question is whether any action will be taken about it. So, yes, Wyss is not a United States citizen. He's not even a legal resident. His money over, we were something like 130 million or so, was marked for non-electoral purposes. But when you've got a fundamentally political organization, one that obviously is engaged in the quest for political change from the radical left, there's really no such thing as non-electoral purposes. So George Charles is an American citizen, but I've actually found research that would suggest that he, on two counts, is actually not legitimately in this country. First, obviously, is the Nazi collaboration past. Most people know about that. That actually makes him deportable under the Holtzman Act. But another point is that actually he came to the United States in the 50s. He was around 25. The first time he applied for a visa to come to the United States from England, he was rejected because he applied for a specialist visa. At the age of 25 back then, you did not actually qualify for a specialist visa. And he received an affidavit from somebody in the financial industry. This affidavit made arguably false claims on his behalf. This is the reason he received a visa to come to the United States. It's the basis for his residency and citizenship in this country, which is really based on immigration fraud. And, you know, if we had a serious conservative administration, they might take a look at that and do something about it.
We didn't the last time around, and it remains to be seen whether we'll ever have another one, I'm afraid. But if so, this certainly ought to be a very important agenda, because what Soros is doing in so many different areas, I think, is incalculably harmful, and he shouldn't be doing it from here, that's for sure. Daniel, let me ask you one question that's more in the foreign policy arena. You follow closely, and I know feel as strongly as I do, about the security of the state of Israel. How would you characterize the Biden administration's approach to Israel and Iran, for that matter, and the Gulf states, with whom Israel had, under the Trump administration, been making considerable strides to achieve not just, you know, a pretty workable modus vivendi, as they say, a way of getting along, but actual Abraham Accords and so on. What's in play now, and where do you think this is likely to leave? Not just Israel, but our vital interests in the Middle East as well.
So the Biden administration is picking up right where the same people, many of the same people in the Obama administration left off. They're picking up on a lot of the policies of the Clinton administration. Their first goal was to overthrow the Israeli government, replace it with a coalition that includes leftists, Islamists, communists, that is more to their liking, which is what the Israeli government now is. It's this artificial hybrid coalition between a former right-wing party and Arab, Islamic, Muslim, including, by the way, the Muslim Brotherhood, and an Arab Communist Party. It's a complete mess. The goal was basically to force out Netanyahu, replace him with a party that is more compliant. Unfortunately, the party can only stay in power by resisting some of the Biden administration's more extreme demands, including their bid to open a consulate to the PLO in Jerusalem in order to claim Jerusalem for the PLO. Now, mind you, when President Trump moved the embassy to Jerusalem, he did it under the terms of an act passed in the Senate that was actually co-sponsored by a guy named Joe Biden. And this really shows the depth of hypocrisy of Biden, because at no point in time were any of the Democrats who voted for this willing to actually move the embassy. And now Biden is doing everything possible to reverse that. Beyond that, he's providing funds to Lebanon's government, which effectively means Hezbollah. He's empowering Iran. He empowered sanctions relief on Iran. He's trying to push for further sanctions relief. Now, Biden ran on a pledge to return to the Iran deal, but it's Iran that is actually holding out for an even better deal because they know that they can continue rolling the Biden administration as much as they want to, much like the Taliban, much like every other Islamic terrorist group has done. Everything that they've done, whether it's lowering sanctions on the Houthis, the various jihadist groups, and the Houthis, by the way, are backed by Iran, responded by escalating, by pushing harder. So the Houthis responded by attacking the former site of the U.S. embassy and taking hostages there. So their goal is to amp up the pressure on the Biden administration. And the Biden administration is fine with this because it gives them an incentive to make a deal, to make further concessions. They actually want to be rolled. They actually want to be pushed into making those concessions. This is much like the same thing that happened with the Taliban in Afghanistan, where what appeared to be weakness was actually an attempt to deliberately create incentives and advantages for the terrorists. And by the way, the Biden administration is still out there, it's still making deals with the Taliban. They just returned from a negotiating session at the end of last month, where the State Department issued a statement praising the openness of the Taliban to dealing with the education for women and girls. Of course, we'll be funding all of that, as with everything else. Now, when it comes to Israel, the goal there, as with the Obama administration, the Clinton administration, has been to undermine Israel, to weaken Israel from within. They're going to fund various anti-Israel groups within the country, particularly with Samantha Power at USA. And it's also to empower the enemies of Israel, the enemies of any kind of stability in the Middle East. That means Iran. That means the Muslim Brotherhood. That means putting pressure on Egypt in order to let the Muslim Brotherhood take over there again. It means weighing in, putting their thumb on the scale. And Libya means actually going into Nigeria. They're actually trying to drop the attempts to monitor the Nigerian government's repression of Christians. So there's this larger global issue there. They're helping Islamists to go after Jews. They're helping Islamists to go after Christians. They're helping Islamists to go after any government that is not sufficiently radical, is not sufficiently Islamized. And obviously that is bad news for Israel. It's bad news for Christians in the Middle East. It's really bad news for America.
Well, that is a comprehensive depiction of the problem, and I thank you for it. The piece that I was particularly interested in drilling down on very quickly, if I can, and I think we're almost out of time, Daniel Greenfield, is the question of whether or not the policies that you've just described in broad outline, as well as specifically with respect to Israel, are likely to put the Israelis in a position where their back is to the wall. They fear, I think rightly so, that the Iranians will imminently have nuclear weapons capabilities, if they don't already, and that there's likely to be no help coming from the United States to protect them against that threat. And therefore, they must, despite the unlikely character and fractures in the Israeli government, take steps on their own to try to dismantle that threat. What's your sense of the prospects there?
Every reaction has an equal and opposite reaction. The Obama administration's championing of Iran, of the Muslim Brotherhood, created a situation where some of the former Sunni Arab oil states, some of the very ones that had been backing these various terrorist groups, these various Islamist movements, suddenly panicked and realized that their old game had come apart. They actually began building the Abraham Accords, the coalition with Israel. I mean, President Trump gets a lot of the credit, but really a lot of the credit goes to Barack Obama for isolating the Saudis, their various allies, for isolating Israel and creating a situation where there was an incentive for countries that had really had very negative relations in the past to come together temporarily against a common enemy. So when you actually have this kind of situation, unexpected things do happen. You have a reaction that may seem to come out of nowhere, but actually is a very logical response to the crisis. Now, the Biden administration has made it abundantly, painfully clear that they want Iran to get nuclear weapons. They're comfortable with doing that. And you're talking about Biden. This is a guy who, after September 11th, proposed sending a $200 million check to Iran, who was tied up with the Iran lobby when he first ran for president. When he was competing against Obama, he was actually attacking Obama for not being pro-Iran enough. So he's been telling Israelis for a while, back in the Senate days, Iran is going to get nuclear weapons. The Israelis know exactly what to expect from the Biden administration. They have absolutely no illusions in that regard. In some ways, the Biden administration is even more pro-Iran. What the Israelis are going to do about it is a question. In the past, there have been this kind of middle ground where they coordinated with the United States on sabotage attacks, some very effective, some very large scale, on Iran's nuclear program. Now the Biden administration is showing signs that they're going to pull away from the sabotage campaign altogether, which obviously leaves the Israelis, it leaves the various players from the Middle East with even fewer options. The potential collapse of the Abraham Accords would potentially be an issue if the Biden administration continues to push for this reconciliation, which I don't think is going to happen between the Saudis and Iran. Either way, the Israelis are going to have to do something about the situation. The question is whether their political stability is going to be there and whether the Biden administration is going to be as aggressive in trying to thwart any Israeli attack on Iran's nuclear program as the Obama administration was. One of the most overlooked stories in the Obama administration was that their espionage efforts before they were spying on President Trump, long before the kind of political office, they were spying on pro-Israel people in the United States. They were using the NSA to go after members of Congress who even had any kind of conversations with the Israelis about what it would take to stop Iran. There's little question that that kind of system can be turned on again. And the Obama administration was out to prevent any Israeli attack on Iran's nuclear program. If the Biden administration is not as careful, is not monitoring things as closely, the Israelis would have more of a chance to take it out.
Well, from your lips to God's ears, I hope that's the case, because I think it's going to be necessary. But I fear that they will be assiduously trying to interfere with anything that the Israelis do. And that could put, again, our friends and allies in Israel in extremis, and make, I think, that much more likely the kind of regional conflict that you've spoken of. Daniel Greenfield, I think we're going to have to leave it at that for the moment. I want to visit with you at some point soon about Ilhan Omar and what she has been up to in the Congress, as well as some of the fracases that she's been involved with, Lauren Boebert, among others, I think, in recent weeks. The problem of the Islamists inside this country is one that you have been, I think, very clear-eyed about, and writing quite powerfully concerning, and we look forward to a chance to visit with you about that and much more in the near future. In the meantime, thank you for your time today, as well as your insights on some of the really important points. And we'll look forward to our next visit. We'll look forward to our next visit with the rest of you as well. I hope you'll join us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Russia's Vladimir Lenin may not have said, quote, the capitalists will sell us the rope with which we hang them, unquote, but it's been a guiding principle for communists worldwide. Those in China have actually gotten capitalists to pay for the purchase of the Chinese-made rope as well. Worse yet, if you participate in pension plans or invest in mutual, index, or exchange-traded funds, chances are good that those Wall Street capitalists are using your money to enable the Chinese Communist Party's unrestricted warfare against us. This insanity is the subject of an urgent webinar sponsored today by our Committee on the Present Danger, China, entitled, Are You Investing in America's Destruction? Please join us at presentdangerchina.org to find out if you are and what you and other patriots unwittingly financing our mortal enemy can do to stop it. This is Frank Gaffney.
No mistake, we are living in dangerous times. Left-wing progressives in government are assaulting our Constitution like no other time in the history of our great nation. Indeed, we hear politicians at the highest levels of government and a major political party espousing what they believe to be the benefits of socialism and the unrestrained growth of the federal government. Fortunately, our Constitution was designed to prevent tyranny and to protect liberty. It enshrines fundamental freedoms in the Bill of Rights, which was designed as a brake on the power of government. In short, our Constitution was designed to protect private citizens like you and me from the tyranny of government. I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center will do its part to hold tyrannical government officials accountable in our courts of law so that we, the people, remain a free people. You can support the important work of the American Freedom Law Center with a tax-deductible donation. Please visit our website at www.AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org.
History was made on today's date. Stay tuned for an American Minute with Bill Federer.
On this day, November 9, 1954, President Eisenhower spoke at the National Conference on the spiritual foundation of American democracy. He stated, "Now, Dr. Lowry said something about my having certain convictions as to a God in heaven and an almighty power. Well, I don't think anyone needs a great deal of credit for believing in what seems to me to be obvious." Eisenhower concluded, "And no matter what democracy tries to do in terms of individual liberty, when you come back to it, there is just one thing. Man is worthwhile because he was born in the image of God."
This has been an American Minute with Bill Federer. For a free transcript, call American Minute at 1-888-USA-WORD.